You know that feeling when your day finally slows down and you just want to relax, unplug, and feel good? That's where Mood.com comes in. They're changing the game, delivering legal THC products right to your door, no shady dealers, and absolutely no medical card required, just good vibes and better sleep, shipped straight from their farm to your couch. From delicious THC gummies, smooth vape pens, to premium THC flower, Mood has it all. And everything's federally legal under the 2018 Farm Bill. Yeah, this isn't some loophole. It's the real deal. Head to Mood.com and use code FIRST20 for 20% off your first order. That's MOOD.com. Find your mood.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
This is the best Toyota to drive around the world. And I don't mean in a metaphorical sense. I mean, if you want to get to the most inhospitable places on the planet, this is the Toyota you should take. Which one is it? Well, we're answering that question today because I'm out here in Montana at the X Overland Ranch, and I had the chance to sit down and talk to the founder of X Overland, an organization that leads some of the greatest adventures of the modern era in brand new Toyotas. And we're gonna find out from their perspective, what is the greatest modern Toyota? What are some of the pros and cons? What are some of the do's and don'ts for modifying these machines? But first, before we do that, let's walk around four of the definitive off-road Toyotas of the modern era and talk about what these vehicles are like side by side. Some of the pros and the cons from a TFL perspective about Land Cruiser versus Forerunner versus Tacoma versus Tundra. And then we'll get Clay on the camera here and we'll hear some stories and some adventures and learn about his experience with these rigs. Now, we got to start here on the right. So this is the 250 series Land Cruiser, one of the most controversial Toyotas of the modern era, because the Land Cruiser name died 4 years ago. I believe 2021 was the last model year of the 200 series. And then they brought it back as the 250 series. And why this is controversial is because the 250 series is not a full-blown Land Cruiser. What I mean by that is for generations now in other parts of the world, there's been a somewhat lighter duty Land Cruiser called the Prado. And now we're getting the Prado here in the US badged as strictly a Land Cruiser. But a lot of the old school Land Cruiser guys claim because it's not a 100, a 200, or a 300 series, it's not really a proper Land Cruiser. But I would argue this was the right call for Toyota to make in this era, because the 200 series, as impressive as it was from a reliability standpoint, simply didn't sell that well. Throughout its long production run, I believe it was 2007, 2008 through 2021, they only averaged 3,000 to 3,500 a year. And this vehicle is selling something like 10 times that amount. And that's because you get the Land Cruiser look, the Land Cruiser feel, the Land Cruiser name, but for $20,000, $30,000 less in some cases compared to the outgoing Land Cruiser. Now, the argument that the 250 detractors would say is you don't get that Land Cruiser reliability. But I would argue these little letters here on the front do come with a certain trust within the off-road community, knowing that they're going to build a good product regardless. Will it last 500,000 miles like the 200 series? You know, the verdict is still out on that. But from, you know, it's been out for some time now, people that own these really seem to like them and really seem to be impressed with the longevity of these machines. And we'll have to see, you know, how history treats these in 20, 30 years if people look back at them and with fondness, or if they look back at them as like a Land Cruiser, a diet Land Cruiser. But anyway, let's talk about the vehicle that you can buy today instead of reminiscing about old vehicles. I think there's a lot to like here. So this is based on the TNGAF architecture, same as the 4Runner, same as the Tacoma, same as the Tundra. So the architecture, the platform is largely shared between these four machines, but I love the form factor you find in this 250 series. It's very boxy, very practical, and it's got an excellent seating position. This is something that is highly underrated in this newest Land Cruiser. Now, coming from a bit of a Land Rover background myself, I love the enemy here. I love how Land Rovers have a command driving position where you sit on top of them instead of in them. And you get that perspective here in the 250 where you get a great view of the world out this huge windshield and out the side windows. And it's just got great visibility and it feels like you're in control of the world in front of you. That is awesome. This is also awesome what we find down here, the full-time four-wheel drive system. So unlike the Forerunner that we're about to check out in a second, where you have to manually select between two high and four high on that Trail Hunter trim, every Land Cruiser is going to have a full-time system with a standard center locking differential and a rear locking differential. And this version I'm sitting in now also has a stability bar disconnect for some added articulation off-road. Now, this is a big deal for folks that want to, you know, live in a snowy climate and not have to worry about what position is my four-wheel drive selector in. It's just a full-time system that's always going to be there and is always going to work for you regardless of the terrain. And that's, you know, that's an underrated thing that people don't often talk about. Now, the other thing I like about this Land Cruiser, and this is going to be a bit of a hot take, but I do like that it's a standard hybrid system. So this is a 2.4 liter turbo gas engine with a hybrid system that's mounted in the back. You do lose some cargo capacity, which is a little bit of a shame. You can't get a third row in this machine, but it does mean that you get quite a bit of instant low-end power. I think peak torque comes in at like 1700 RPM. So these are really easy to off-road. They're immensely spacious because they are just a perfect box. We got this thing loaded up with paddle boards here. It could take many, many more. And then you get decent towing capacity in this vehicle as well. Standard hitch, standard brake controller, another highly underrated thing. I think these tow 6,000 pounds, if memory serves me right, but standard integrated brake controller. So there's a lot to like here. Pricing, they start at about 60, they can go well into the $70,000 region. But of what I've seen about 250, and I've driven quite a few of them and I've wheeled them, we actually wheeled them pretty hard today, they are impressive machines. This one does have 20-inch wheels, which wouldn't be my first choice, but wrapped in a decent tire, this is a Ridge Grappler tire, that actually performed really well off-road. It's got frame-mounted rock rails. This thing is awesome. But let's go ahead and transition over to its younger, maybe more athletic cousin. So this is the Forerunner Trail Hunter. Now, this is the top dog version of the new sixth generation Forerunner, also based on the TNGAF architecture, also with that 2.4 liter turbo engine, also with the hybrid system. But shockingly, we live in an era where likely, I don't have the full specs on these because some of these are pre-production, there's some things going on here, but typically a Trail Hunter Forerunner can actually be more than a Land Cruiser. So this is probably a $70,000 Forerunner that we see here. And that's probably a $65,000 Land Cruiser. So kind of a crazy world we live in. Now you can really see the stance of this Forerunner. So it's wider, it's got more rubber on it than the Land Cruiser. And it does have some advantages over the Land Cruiser. Now, if you really care about maximum all-out capability, this is likely gonna be the most off-road worthy Toyota from a rock crawl standpoint. You get really good clearance, solid rear axle. This thing also has locking rear diff, stabilizer bar disconnect, but they've also gone kind of nutso with some of the skid plating. Now I'm going to attempt to show you some pretty cool things here. Let's see if I can do this just by myself. So if I crawl underneath here, like look at that standard rear diff protection. If I compare that over here to the 250 series, right, you get your exposed rear diff. This thing has an absurd amount of underbody protection. And I got to give Toyota a lot of credit for doing that. Look at that. You got that TRD, Trail Hunter skid plate right there in the front. That extends underneath the engine. This is a capable, impressive machine from a protection standpoint, which I really appreciate. They also give you, they're a little gimmicky, but they give you rigid fog lights. They give you an integrated off-road light bar. They give you the raised air intake, all from the factory. So it's got the ARB roof rack on it, right? Out back, you can kind of see how that rear bumper is integrated. So there's some cool stuff in this Trail Hunter. And of course, you know, you've got the legendary, I don't know if I have the key on me here, but if I did have the key on me, oop, Now I've made it mad. You have the, oh man, everything's falling out of this thing. You've got the rear window that goes down. So slightly less usable cargo space in this vehicle. It also has kind of an absurdly tall liftover height. You still have that high voltage battery, but because the whole rig is higher off the ground, it's a bit of a lift to actually get things into the back seat of this thing. And then as we come around on the inside, a couple of things worth noting. I like the seats more in the 4Runner than the Land Cruiser. I find them to be a little bit more supportive and kind of grip my sides a little bit better. This Trail Hunter has this kind of cool orange stitching and orange piping along both edges. You also get kind of this granite finish across the dashboard and this massive screen. So if you're into screen sizes, this 4Runner is going to be the choice for you. But one thing I don't like is there's no option for a full-time four-wheel drive system. Now, you can get that on very, very select 4Runner models, like the Limited, like the Platinum, I believe you can get it, but they're not off-road trims. They're more the city slicker 4Runners. So the fact that they won't sell you that in the standard 4Runner with that cool viscous center diff, my brain after a full day of off-roading is fried. What's the Limited slip style diff? Torsen, I think it's a Torsen Limited slip that Toyota uses in their off-road vehicles. But look, dashboard design, right? A little bit more fun. It's got a little bit more pizzazz to it. You got the backlit kind of Toyota emblem there in the yellow. You get the Trail Hunter badges there along the side of the door. So there's some cool things about this vehicle, but my concern with this is just I have a fundamentally hard time paying $70,000 for a 4Runner when you can get a Land Cruiser badge instead with a more kind of refined interior and a better seating position, and it's easier to see out of, and I just didn't get more towing capacity in the Land Cruiser and a standard brake controller. So I just think for me, the 250 is the way to go in the SUV space. But we got a whole world of trucks we got to talk about. So what we have here are the two Toyota pickups in the off-road space. So we'll start with the bright orange here. This is a Tacoma. Now, Tacoma's been out for a couple of years now, and there's a ton of different trims. This is the trim to get, actually. This is the TRD Off-Road. This is the secret within the whole Toyota lineup. See if I can reposition my camera here. Is if you are looking for an off-road Toyota, largely, for most folks, skip the Pro, skip the Trail Hunter. This is the truck for you, right? You get the locking rear diff. You can get it with, I believe, a sway bar disconnect. You get pretty decent tires. You get pretty decent underbody protection. And you save a ton of money over a Pro or a Trail Hunter. Now, this is a cool color, too. I really like this bright orange on this Tacoma. Interior, it's going to be pretty much identical to that 4Runner. And all of the features we see are going to be pretty much identical to the 4Runner. So from an off-road standpoint, we still have the part-time system. We have a locking rear diff. We got a stabilizer bar disconnect, crawl control, multi-terrain select. So it does have a brake controller. This does tow more than the 4Runner, which is great. Still very well equipped if you get the premium package here. You get heated and ventilated seats, dual zone automatic climate control. We got wireless charging, USB-C ports. You get a sunroof, you even get a digital rearview mirror. So very, very well equipped machine. Of course, everything from the cluster to the main screen has gone full digital here. So same thing, just like the 4Runner, you can get it in a couple different engine configurations, iForce Max in this Tacoma, which means it is a hybrid trim. The key with these hybrid systems is don't expect stellar fuel economy. You might get like a 1 or 2 mpg bump over the non-hybrid, but you get a lot more torque. I believe these are rated up to 465 pound-feet of torque, which is a lot of torque, right? Now, there's a couple things I like and dislike about the Tacoma. Obviously, it's a truck, right? So if you wanted to build out a camper shell or an over-the-cab style camper, this is going to be a good option for you. Problem is, you are somewhat limited still on payload capacity. Let's go ahead and check out the payload info. 1,200 pounds, actually pretty decent. Not bad for a midsizer, but what you are really limited in is rear seat space. So if we check out the rear seat space between that Tacoma and this Land Cruiser, or sorry, 4Runner, you're just gonna end up with a much more comfortable rear seat. You get more slant to the backrest. You got more space for your legs. This is just a better place to spend time in the 4Runner than the Tacoma. The Tacoma rear seat is just too small. Plus you don't get rear AC vents in the Tacoma. And if we look at this 4Runner, you do get rear AC vents. So there are pros and cons to Tacoma from an off-roading standpoint, right? You got a pretty exposed exhaust, which I never have liked on these Tacomas from a departure angle standpoint. You got kind of a long tail. And then you just have a lot of sheet metal down the side on most of these that has gone relatively exposed from a armor standpoint, but still very capable machines, right? A lot of people sleep on the capability of these new fourth gen Tacomas out on the trail, and they will go places that you wouldn't expect them to go, especially if you get them with the stabilizer bar disconnect like this one. Good articulation, good underbody protection for what it is, right? You don't get the fancy stamping in the skid plate, but you do get a skid plate there. Yeah, I like Tacomas. Even though fourth gen, a little bit controversial with going turbo and hybrid only, still a good machine. And then that brings us to the oldest of the bunch now. We're looking at full-sized Tundra. Now, first and foremost, if you want space inside and outside, Tundra is the way to go. Tacoma rear seat, pretty unusable. Tundra rear seat, absolutely monstrous. It's a really, really impressive rear seat. And then you also talk about bed capacity, right? You get a larger bed, you get a wider bed, much more usable if you wanted to put in a camper shell back here or haul your stuff around. This is going to be the way to go from a size standpoint. The downside of Tundra is the size standpoint. So if we look at even this machine next to the Tacoma, let me come on over here and close up this door, you can just immediately see the width, right? This is a wide machine, and yeah, it does hide its size pretty well, but a full-size truck, depending on your kind of off-roading, is just going to be tough to squeeze down the trail. Now, this will do it. This has a lot of the stuff you need. It still has skid plates. It still has a good four-wheel drive system, but it's just you're limited to some trail networks by the overall size. And then you talk about the engine, right? It's got a good, powerful 3.4-liter twin-turbo V6. This one also is a hybrid system. Tons of power on board, which is cool, but you're also going to be using quite a bit more fuel than this Tacoma. The other consideration, which I'm going to make because I'm a 90-year-old man, is just the interior comfort. Now, these seats, they're a little flat and a little unsupportive, but this is a comfortable machine, right? It's pretty soft. You got tons of space. Everywhere you look, it's just there's space and space and space. It's fairly easy to see out of from the side, a little tricky with the fall off on the hood, but it's a good road tripper, better than all the rest. You get pretty much the same technology as you would find in other Toyota products. Now, if we look at the off-road gear, part-time four-wheel drive system, rear locking diff, no sway bar disconnect, but this Pro does have the Fox shocks, just like other Pros in the Toyota lineup. I do like driving these Tundras. Something about them that is just kind of nice, especially if you're just looking at dirt roads and rough roaded out service roads. They're just long wheelbase, they're comfy, they're well sorted, they don't squeak, they don't rattle, they just kind of float, and then you can carry a bajillion things in the back. Let's go ahead and check out the payload on this rig here. Checking in the door here, 1380, so 180 pounds more than the Tacoma. Let's go see 4Runner payload. It's gonna be kind of an interesting little comparison. Popping open the door. Looks like we got 895. That's nothing. So very limited payload capacity in the Trail Hunter, especially for what's supposed to be kind of an off-road trim. Not a lot if you want to hold many, many things. And then if we jump over to this Land Cruiser over here, payload capacity 1100. So look, for me, if I wanted to go take one of these vehicles on an adventurous off-road challenge, even if it was just in the US like I typically do, for me, I think I'm going Land Cruiser. This is a good balance of comfort, which the Tundra has more of, but also size. This is a nice size for trail use. It's also a lot lighter than the old Land Cruiser, so it feels much more nimble. And it's got all the off-road gear, plus a full-time four-wheel drive system, plus the storage capacity that comes along with driving around in a giant box. So for me, I think the Land Cruiser is going to be the choice to go with. But let's go talk to someone that lives this lifestyle, the Overland lifestyle, and let's learn about his background and some of the pros and the cons between these vehicles. All right, everybody. So today we are joined with one of the definitive legends of the four-wheel drive community. So Clay, can you introduce yourself?
Sure. My name's Clay with X Overland, and been traveling around the world in four-wheel drive vehicles for 20 years now.
And we got another legend in the back seat, Talon Wave.
I'm just listening live podcast back here.
So Clay runs X Overland and has gone on some of probably the most interesting expeditions of like the last decade. Is that fair to say? In at least in new Toyota vehicles.
Yeah, I think. Yeah, there's a lot of people doing cool things out there, but I've been fortunate to do some cool stuff too.
So kind of walk me through the genesis of X Overland, where you got the idea.
Sure.
And how it came to be.
Let's see. So I was a broke and struggling artist, starving artist, filmmaker. This is like 2009. Somewhere in there.
Okay.
And I had been able to get on a couple jobs that were teaching me how to work in remote areas and tell stories, mostly in Alaska. And then I'd gone on a documentary team to go to Uganda and do some content work in Africa. And I came home from that. And then that's right when the economy really took a dive in Montana in that right 2009, 2010 time frame. And I lost all my work in a week from being home after being in Africa for a month. I got home and within a week I lost all my work.
Ugh.
So I kind of hit this point where I was like, well, I don't know. I could either continue to look for work or I can start doing my own thing. And one night I was coming out of the garage into the house, and I looked in the garage and there was a stock 100 series that I had just bought for the family. And I'd kind of been working on my Tacoma at the time. It was a first gen Tacoma. And I said, you know what, maybe we could shoot a show on traveling by vehicle. And that's what kicked it all off. And we said, we went and shot a pilot, a sizzle reel at the time, in Moab, Utah. First time I'd ever been to Moab, went and shot this little sizzler and started shopping it. And then that just grew into what is now X Overland. But it was originally for television, but we never went to TV. We eventually went to YouTube and Vimeo and all that. And we just rode the wave of all of that, and here we are today.
So how many series have you guys done in the past 16 years?
Ooh. We're working on this, I think we're on series number 7 right now, big series.
Yep.
The Milestones Expedition, and then we've done many other series outside of that. So over the last 15 main years of building content, we're somewhere around 120 episodes of like high-end episodic content.
And I think what's cool about X Overland too is you guys have been not just throughout our continent but all around the world, right? I mean, have you been to the 6 major ones?
Yeah, so the only one I'm missing right now is Antarctica.
Okay.
And sadly I had to say no to Antarctica in 2013. I was gonna had the invite to go on the E7 expedition to cross Antarctica, but I had to say no to it. Okay. And I've kicked myself ever since. It's like the hardest continent to get to, and I had to say no to it. But it's okay. We'll get there eventually.
So, Clay, you've been around the world, and one of the things I want to talk about in this little mini podcast is the vehicles you've chosen. So you've been partnered with Toyota for quite some time.
Yeah.
And you guys have done some really cool build-outs. So, you know, you talked about starting back in the old days with some of the first gen stuff, but then like you quickly moved on to 4Runner, right? And now you have a whole arsenal of Toyota four-wheel drive. So kind of walk me through that evolution and how that's happened.
Yeah, so personal vehicles were 100 series Land Cruiser and Tacoma in the very beginning.
Okay.
And we used those for the start of the show. It wasn't until, so we started X Overland in 2010, and it wasn't until 2015 that we got a Toyota partnership. So up until that point, we had bought all of our own vehicles, and we've bought many since, but Toyota started supporting us with vehicles and financial commitment, which has really helped us grow our channel, you know. So that's when we got the 4Runners for Central America. And ironically, it's, you know, back in the day, we got kind of flagged a lot for like, oh, these trucks are way overbuilt. And now if you look around, like our trucks are fairly moderately built, you know, compared to what's out there now.
Yeah.
There's so many amazing things out there. But, yeah, we went to Central America with a hidden winch front bumper, stock steps on the back, a CBI rear bumper, wow, a roof rack, and some guts, you know?
Yeah,
and
right,
we went to Central America like that. So our stuff was pretty bone stock at the time. And even now, with the Milestones Expedition, we are doing, two of our vehicles are nearly bone stock trail hunters going from the top of the world to the bottom.
Wow.
So we've built everything in between, you know, really modified vehicles and to now still running stock vehicles. Of course, stock vehicles are, as we know now, they're getting really good.
Right.
You know, from off the lot. 10 years ago, 15 years ago, that wasn't the case. You know, they, you kind of had to modify them a lot. But now, like Toyota and those, everybody's building some more built-up stuff that we don't have to modify as much.
So the title of this podcast is, what's the best Toyota to take around the world?
Ooh.
And I kind of want to go through, like, some of the pros and the cons of, yeah, the rigs that you've driven to some of these really remote places.
Oh,
so,
yeah,
so let's start with that fifth gen. What are some of the things that folks should know if they want to go on a big adventure in the fifth gen 4Runner?
They're bulletproof. So it is a bulletproof vehicle. What you run into is the livability factor. So all Toyotas in general are reliable vehicles. Mm. They're all modifiable vehicles. You can get them all to the point that you want them to be at for your performance level of whatever. But there's some things that you can't change. And whether you're living on top of it, or living in it, or out of it, right?
Okay.
So 4Runners in particular, you're gonna have to have a rooftop tent on top. You're gonna be using an organizational system to access the back. And so you live on top in a tent, and you work out of the back, right? That they're also a little bit short to sleep in the back of.
Hmm.
So if you're of smaller stature, a 4Runner can be great to live out of the back of. Like build a sleep platform back there. And as you start traveling the world, being able to sleep inside the vehicle is actually a pretty big bonus.
Yeah.
You might want to be parked somewhere where you don't want to be up in a rooftop tent, letting everyone know that you're there.
Right.
You know, so you can hide out in your car and wake up in the morning and move, you know. But, and then if you go to like Tacomas and trucks, well, then that's when we can get into camper systems. You can stand in the back of them. You can live out of the back of them. You can cook in the back of them. So, yeah. And then you just pick your size. You want the smaller vehicle for a lot of trails and nimbleness. Like, if you're going to be doing Central America, even Africa, Europe, where the roads are really narrow, having a Tacoma or a 4Runner-sized vehicle is, like, ideal because you just zip around.
Yeah,
as soon as you step into Sequoia and tundra, then you like you feel really big in the world, but you also have more space. So
right. So in general, because you've done so many of these amazing expeditions, like do you prefer the enclosed SUV body style for the type of travel you do, or are you more of an open bed, build your own camping configuration kind of guy? What have you preferred over the years?
Yeah, so I like a truck bed.
Okay.
And I love building a camper system on the back.
Okay.
Because I like to step up into it. When I was younger, I loved the SUV and the rooftop tent on top of it. I like a Land Cruiser.
Yeah,
You can't beat a Land Cruiser, right?
Like, yeah.
It's a Land Cruiser. It's bulletproof. It's amazing. The heritage and, you know, the Land Cruisers are so famous for a very good reason.
Hmm.
But I like to live in the back of a truck.
Okay.
Yeah.
And is that just because of, like, the configurability that offers? Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it's really because the more time you spend, and you see this throughout a lot of other global travelers, people that travel a lot, even in the U.S., I guess, the more you do it, the more kind of living space you end up wanting.
Gotcha.
So you start out on your weekend warrior world, and having that rooftop tent is great, you know. And we still use them now, but for weekend warrior trips. But if you're going to be gone for any amount of time, or you're going to be in multiple environments, like in seasons, cold, wet, windy, all those things, and you have to live in the elements, and stepping into the back of a camper in the back turns into a pretty nice thing.
I bet. Yeah.
Everyone seems to migrate that way over time.
So you've done a bunch with Forerunner. Let's talk a little bit about Tacoma, because you've spent thousands of miles in third gen, and now fourth gen as well. So what are some of the lessons you've learned comparing the older Tacomas to the newer stuff?
What Toyota has done really well is they have what they call the Tacoma-ness.
Okay.
You know, Tacoma-ness is, if I hop in a previous gen or a first gen and you hop into the latest gen, you can still tell that it's a Tacoma. And a Tacoma has been, if I'm not mistaken, on every single one of our expeditions.
Really?
Yeah.
No way.
The entire Pan American, the Africa series, the Nordic series, and now we have two more on our Milestones expedition this year, which is a 25,000 mile trip. So we've driven on every of our ex-overland continents with a Tacoma, and I will say that that's my favorite truck. Tacoma is my preferred vehicle to travel around the world in.
And now, is there a generation aspect to that, or is it just as a whole Tacoma's?
As a whole, as we've been working through the generations over the years, Tacoma has always been, you know, it has always shined in one way or another. The newest generation. So now everybody is like, well, are they going to hold up? You know, like, where's the durability?
The next question, yeah.
You know, how about these turbos? How about these hybrids? How about all that? I can tell you this now. I've already got, I've got 20,000 expedition miles in the new Trail Hunters, and I would never go back to the previous generation Tacoma.
Really? Even with the type of travel you do?
Yeah, hook, line, and sinker into the new trucks.
And what is it about the new gens that gets you so excited?
The drivability of them.
Okay.
So, and, you know, we got a lot of things that we did want. We got our disc brakes. We got our linkages in the rear, the five link versus, you know, standard leafs and all that. There's some good advantages to that. But it's really, to me, in the drivetrain and the hybrid systems. They are just so awesome to drive. They get out of their own way. You know, it's not the Tacomas and of the past where you're like, I gotta wring its neck to get around, you know?
Right.
It's just ready and responsive, even with the weight of a fully built overland vehicle.
Yeah, and how do they respond to, you know, camper shells, to bumpers, to...
Awesome.
So even with like, you know, the new cooling needs and intercooler needs that a turbocharger in your brings, do you find that like it's more difficult to modify and work around those additional requirements for turbocharged engines?
No.
Okay.
Not yet.
Interesting.
Depends on the, this is always going to come down to the level of modification that you're doing. So under X-Overland, we hardly ever do anything to the engine. We hardly ever do any tuning to it. In fact, we've only tuned one vehicle ever, just for fun.
Okay.
And then where we have found the biggest drawback, and we've talked to Toyota engineers about this, is just building in ways for our electrical systems to be easier to tie into. So you know, traditionally your start battery was under the hood. Now with your hybrids, it's under the back seat sitting right here. So now when you're doing winch line runs and all that, like, it's just adding some complication in these areas. But in general, it's just like wiring any other truck.
Right.
You know, so, I don't know, have you seen, what have you heard out
there?
Like, I'm just curious, maybe I can answer more specifically.
I'm just grilling you on this because there is kind of this thing that we've been seeing a lot online with the latest generation of Toyota trucks.
Yeah.
And you know, there's this belief that turbocharging of the modern era has, I think that there was some truth that back in the 1980s, turbocharged engines put a lot of pressure in places that pressure shouldn't be for the long term, right?
Yeah.
And there wasn't the ability to kind of cool these engines in a way that they needed to be maintained, so they ended up with a lot of premature failures. So I'm asking, Clay, because you've been around the world more times than just about anybody in this planet, like, do you have any concern about the longevity of these vehicles?
I think there's logical concern because there is, I wouldn't even say a concern, it's logical consideration that something that's new could fail.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, all of these things are machines. Machines fail. There's an old adage with expeditions that expeditions are complex systems and complex systems fail. Right?
Interesting.
Vehicles are complex systems. Complex systems fail. So as we add complexity,
right,
which most of these OEMs are being forced to do, mm-hmm. you know, because of government regulation and all that. So this is not just a universal or a single problem that Toyota's having.
Yeah.
Every auto manufacturer, the industry is having this problem, right? So everyone's starting to solve it in different ways. But with complexity will come failures to a certain degree.
Right.
What I fall back on, where my confidence comes from, is the years of scrutiny that Toyota, especially from the Japan side, has had on the vehicle's reliability factor.
Yeah.
For example, back in the day, you could get a TRD supercharger for a vehicle, right? Mm-hmm. For a Toyota, off the lot. So what they did there is, in order for Japan, I'm paraphrasing this, so they said, all right, TRD department, which is a U.S. thing, right? TRD is a U.S. thing. They said, you can have this supercharger, but you got to run all these tests on it. And you have to run it for 1,000 hours at this high RPM and like essentially burn up the engine as fast as you possibly can so we can see where it fails. Hmm. And then they had to submit it back to Japan. And they looked at it, and one cylinder had a slight score in it.
Wow.
And they didn't approve it.
Was this 3.4 or 5.7?
This is 3.4.
3.4, okay.
And 5.7. They had to do the same test for both, if I recall.
Yeah.
So then they said, go back to the drawing board. This can't happen.
Right.
And it was the most extreme test possible.
Yeah.
Right? Like, this is, like, above and beyond. But that is the threshold that Toyota requires of their durability.
Yeah.
So when they put a turbo in the new vehicles, I'm like, okay. I know what they've done on other machines in the past.
Right.
It's going to be okay.
Well, and I, from a personal note, I'm completely on that same train.
Yeah.
In that, you know, talking to these engineers, right? Mm-hmm. If Toyota's going to do anything, they're so unbelievably conservative with the longevity of every single aspect of every vehicle they do.
Yeah.
That I think that kind of that online echo chamber of turbos are unreliable and that these vehicles aren't going to last as long as the old ones, I think is just largely urban myth in my opinion. And like I go back to when 250 series came out in the US as hybrid only, right?
Yeah.
And a lot of the Land Cruiser folks were really freaked about the hybrid system. But if you actually dive deep into what makes that thing tick, you realize, well, Toyota's been doing hybrids now since 2001 in the U.S.
Yeah.
Development started in the
Prius,
mid-90s.
Right?
Yeah. And if you even look at, like, the battery technology, I mean, I've criticized Toyota in the past, is they're using practically antiquated nickel metal hydride battery technology, which is so energy inefficient from a density standpoint.
Yes.
But that's because they know after hundreds and thousands of cycles of charging and discharging, it's going to last.
Yeah.
Right. So I'm in that same boat, Clay, with the turbocharging systems of these modern engines, that if Toyota's going to put a badge on it, it's probably going to be pretty well made.
Yeah.
Right? And certainly there are instances where Toyota has struggled, like with the frame issues and second gen Tacomas.
Totally.
Right. Yeah. Now, you know, there's that discussion on 3.4 failures, but with any new technology, there is that risk. And I think the most important thing to remember about both these issues is Toyota's standing behind the product.
Totally.
And they did the frame replacements and they're replacing 3.4s now.
Yeah. And Toyota is I know a lot of the engineers personally.
Okay.
And like Sheldon Brown and
Swears.
Mike Swears. And, every time you get around the campfire with those guys, they talk about failing forward.
Hmm.
You know?
Okay.
So like, and it's also part of the Toyota way, you know, one of the four pillars of Toyota is You know, it's okay. Fail forward, essentially. I would get the name wrong. Like, it's all the...
Anyway. Sure. I know
we can put that down here. The four colors
we'll,
of...
We'll font it here. Yeah.
But one is, you know, go and find out. Go to the source. Figure it out. And then... But a big one is, you know, the fail forward. Find out what fails and constant improvement. Hmm. Constant improvement. So when they do find a failure, they love to figure out why.
Okay.
You know?
Interesting.
I heard this story of these guys. I think it was TFL. You may have heard. but, you know, they had a failure in the front point. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And you know what Sheldon and all those guys went and did, right?
Yeah, we made their lives pretty miserable.
but in the greatest way possible, they took it. I mean, they flew those parts to Japan with them on the airplane.
That's crazy.
You know, like, yeah. We got to go figure this out right now. Mm-hmm. And they've solved that problem.
Yeah.
Like, they handled it right away.
Yeah, to their credit, they were on top of it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is cool.
And again, complex systems fail. And any new gen is going to have problems of one way or another. We see it on all vehicles. It's just part of the system. So I really think it's important that we judge any auto manufacturer by how they handle the failures versus what the failure was.
Oh, that's a great way of putting it. So, Clay, I want to talk a little bit about the vehicle in front of us, which is the 250 series Land Cruiser, which is kind of this new launch in the U.S. where they're bringing the Prado in underneath the Toyota brand now instead of just GX. And that's also been a very controversial move to a lot of Toyota fans because 300 series, at least the Land Cruiser badged one, isn't available in the States.
Right.
What's been your take on that, especially now that you guys have spent a lot of time wheeling one, you've got a really cool modified one. What have you thought of this platform and the decision not to bring the 300 over?
Well, I can't wait for the day, hopefully, that they do bring a 300 over. I don't know if they will. I honestly don't know. We can get, you know, you get the equivalent in the 600 series Lexus, you know. So if you really do want that platform, you can find it. You just got to get it through Lexus.
Right.
Through the history of Land Cruiser was struggling with sales in the U.S. for a long time. And even back in the day when we were... When we got a 200 series Land Cruiser Samson years ago, people said, oh, they'll never support you. They'll never give you a Land Cruiser because they never put any marketing behind the Land Cruiser. Mm. Well, there's a lot of economical reasons back in the day for that. So at the end of the day, don't forget that all these guys have to make, they're dealing with government regulations and they have to turn a profit. Mm. So we as enthusiasts can really battle that. Because we have this passion for these things, and I do too.
Yeah.
You know, I love Land Cruiser, but there's business sense that eventually the higher ups say, well, we can't be emotionally attached to this, we have to make these decisions. So it was sad to see the Land Cruiser go when the 200 was done. And then we thought for a while, man, we're not even gonna see him come back. And then they said, well, let's try this 250 platform Prado. Maybe it'll do better in the U.S. and we can keep the Land Cruiser going in the U.S. So enter 250, and it's been a huge success. So the way I see this is another good foothold of rejuvenating the Land Cruiser name and heritage into the U.S. And hopefully that leads us to better platforms, bigger platforms in the future.
Right. Do you think that kind of that, you were talking about the Tacoma-ness, transitioning from third to fourth gen, do you think that Land Cruiser-ness has made the progression as well from 100 to 200 now into 250?
It's tough to compare 200 to 250.
Okay.
The Land Cruiser 200 versus the 250. Even though they still have 200 in their name, they're very different. Mm. So it's Prado to Prado, light duty, right? Prado is the light-duty Land Cruiser rest of world.
Yep.
So Prado to Prado, these are very, very Land Cruiser-y. That's
sure.
a word.
Yeah, right. You know? Land Cruiser-y. I like that.
Land Cruiser-y. I personally bought a Land Cruiser 250, just like the one ahead of us, same color, everything, because of how it checked the boxes that we as a family wanted. We wanted the Land Cruiser heritage name. We love the styling of it. I like the boxiness. I love the taller roof versus the 4Runner, which is, you know, where they kind of compete the most. They're just different I'm over 40, so I want the Land Cruiser. Let's just say that. And then if I was 25, like my son, he'd want the 4Runner.
He's the 4Runner. You know? Yes, base, yeah.
So this is the more mature system. Now, what if I was to get really nerdy, I love the GX version of the 250 because a little bigger differentials, all that. But that's all things that we might see come in later generations of this Land Cruiser, right?
Right.
But the big news for me and what I love about it is that Land Cruiser's back and it's been very well received.
So Talon and I were talking about this a little yesterday because he's super deep into the modification world within the new gens of Toyota.
Yeah.
And I want to get your take on this too, Clay, as I know that like with third gen Tacoma, with previous generation 4Runner, it was tough to put big, quote unquote, big tires underneath them without getting the Sawzall out and doing some shopping here and there. Yep. And I know like the enthusiasts complain that like, look, over at the Jeep and the Ford world, you can put 35s and 37s with no body modifications at all. Has Toyota in this new gen of truck, have they made improvements for folks like you that are going out and doing crazy things from the aftermarket side of things?
Yes, some.
Okay.
Toyota is a company, and you know, I don't work for them, so I can't. I work with them, but I don't work for them.
Sure.
Yeah. You know, so I don't want to speak for them, but they have a very, as we discussed earlier, a very specific tolerance to risk and modification, because there's a whole bunch of legalities out there in the world that. Toyota is very conservative on things and other companies are not. And it's just how they interpret some of the laws out there and how far they're willing to push it. Toyota doesn't really push it that hard. Let's just say that. But they have made what I would say, you know, what I've heard engineers say, we gave a nod towards certain things that you may want to do, but we were also held within our build requirements and our restrictions that we have to hit as a corporation.
Okay.
So we are seeing that there is more room for tires, bigger tires.
Okay.
You know, we are seeing, you know, and that doesn't mean we don't have to modify. We may have to modify them a little bit, but not like we used to. It's not quite to that degree. The problem also with this industry is 10 years ago, if you had a 33-inch tire, you had a huge tire. That was a big tire. And then that was kind of like the deal for, I don't know, 10 years. And then it went to 35s. And now all of a sudden, we're at 37s.
Yeah.
You know, everyone's wanting to put 37s on there. By the way, a 37 and even a 35, mostly a 37, is really a trail-specific tire size. If we're really wanting to run trails like we're about to run today, a 37 is awesome, you know? But you can drive around the world on 33-inch tires. Mm. In fact, almost all the off-road tires in Africa are 32s.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
All the overland vehicles ripping across the South Africa and the Land Cruiser and stuff, they might be a 33.
They're 32 or 33. Yeah. Wow.
So this big tire thing is definitely a U.S. thing.
That's super interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But there's a reason for it, right? It's nice on the trails.
Right.
So while we can fit a 35 pretty easily now on most of the new modern vehicles, you know, Talon's got 37s on his. I'd be curious, what did you have to do to get 37s in there?
Surprisingly, not as much as you would think.
Okay, good. So the head nod from the engineers is there, right?
Yeah, right.
Okay.
No, I mean, I think that it's, from where I'm sitting, it's interesting because, you know, I work closely with all the other OEMs and communities.
Yeah.
Not that you don't, Clay, because you're more plugged in than I'll ever be. But it's interesting. Like, I was just out on the Rubicon with the Jeep guys, and I was talking to some of the Jamboree vets who've been doing it for 35 years.
Yeah.
And, like, the ballooning of tire size has just increased and increased. Like, they said that for the first 30 years of the Rubicon Trail, from the 50s to the 80s, everyone was running flat fenders on 29s, right?
Yeah.
And then, like, as you got into the 90s, you saw some guys on 31s and then 33s. And then 33 was the tire size for a long time in the Jeep community. And then, like, 35 became the tire size. And then it was 37, and now it's 40, and now it's 44. So it was, like, an exponential growth.
Huge.
And he said the downside of that, especially with more and more horsepower in a lot of these modern rigs is the trails are getting chewed to hell.
Oh, yeah.
Because you got massive tire with a lot of torque.
Agreed.
It's a recipe. And I've actually talked to some of the tire companies. I'm like, when is there a maximum where, like, this is going to have to stop?
Yeah.
And the BFG guys were like, we're, in their opinion, that we were pretty much there.
We're there.
Like, 40, 44. Like, it's not, from a DOT standpoint, it's going to be tough to certify a tire.
And there's so much engineering factors that go into the rolling resistance of a 44-inch tire, you know? So, oh, even a 37, even right. a 35, that's why it's, I'm not really sure, but it's got to be like this exponential curve of power and stress and wear and tear on componentry and all that stuff. So we're gaining certain things, but it is certainly coming at a cost to the reliability of machines.
So talking to folks like Sheldon, when they engineer these vehicles, like Toyota will spend hundreds and thousands of hours, for example, like on that rear suspension you were talking about earlier, with geometries and making sure that that is the optimal geometry for on-road use while still hitting their off-road targets. What do you, from what you guys do, and especially from what Talon does, how do you feel about immediately pulling that stuff off and bolting on aftermarket stuff that's taking that geometry and then kind of changing it immediately? Like, is there concern that what you're doing to your vehicle is fundamentally making it worse? That's a terrible way of putting it, but you see what I'm trying to say?
I think that's a great way of putting it.
Okay.
So we as overlanders do a really good job of ruining our vehicles. Okay? So the best and most reliable vehicle that you will ever buy is the Tacoma, the Land Cruiser, the 4Runner, the Tundra off the lot, and you keep it just like that, right? Okay. It'll run, and that's why we always look, when you go buy a used truck, you're looking for that truck that's never been modified. Mm. Because we know that the modifications add stress to other components that they weren't designed to be. And there's no way that any OEM could design and test for all the factors of modification in the world, right?
Right.
Because already, like, even this year, portals blew up, right? All of a sudden, everyone wants portals on their truck.
Yeah, that's what Talon was saying.
So it's like, well, did Toyota or GMC or anybody ever expect to build componentry that would handle a portal? A $20,000 accessory that would go onto your vehicle.
Right.
You know, that's like way out of spec. So they built a truck for the greatest use case scenario. And then as soon as we start modifying it outside of that, we become test pilots.
Interesting.
Right. So now we can do it creatively and smart.
Right.
You know, because the industry has been modifying vehicles for a long time. We already know now what, we probably shouldn't do this or that because it will break.
Yeah.
So we even understand our the mechanics of and the limitations of things. But that's why we're kind of, as ex-Overland, we try to keep our build specs pretty simple and within the componentry, because for one, we just don't want them to break, and we don't want to have to try and figure this stuff out, fixing it in the field somewhere in the world. So
right. So off of that same vein, because you are so plugged into the Overland community and with ex-Overland and all you do, what are some like do's and don'ts if you're modifying your vehicle for a long distance adventure like you guys go on?
Yeah. That's a great question. If you're running older vehicles, the top line thing that we should be focused on is making sure that the baseline mechanical reliability is there. A lot of times people will go and they'll buy that new vehicle or that old vehicle, it's new to them, but they don't spend the money going through and making sure that the CV axles are new, that the bushings are new, that, you know, like doing the kind of the chores of maintaining a vehicle. They'll go right to putting on advanced systems, and then they have other reliability problems because they didn't baseline the vehicle is the way they should have.
Gotcha.
You know, and you see it a lot. You have an older vehicle. My son just went through this. He has a 2015 truck, I believe, Tacoma, and he just went through an ARB suspension upgrade. Mm. So he just put the MT64s on his truck.
Nice.
And he said, all right, in the next 5,000 miles, watch everything, because your CV axles, your drive lines, have all been under stock configuration for 10 years, for 100,000 miles. Mm. And now you just put stress on it with new suspension, you put a bigger tire on it, watch what grenades. You know, something's gonna now fail because you exponentially increased its failure rate under new stresses.
Right.
So CVs and that always usually give up.
Yeah.
Bushings and all that. They might have lasted 5 more years in the current configuration, but now we put all this new stuff on it, it fails within 3 months. Mm-hmm. So baseline your stuff. Regearing was a big deal for a long time. And in the older vehicles, it still is. Like your nitro gears, your Yukon gear and axle. If you can find OE gear ratios from the manufacturer, you're going to be better off. Because the metallurgy is much better in those gears versus any aftermarket gear because of scalability.
Okay.
The cost of what it takes to make a really high-end metal part for an aftermarket is way higher than it is for Toyota, who makes millions of them every year.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's just scale. So if you can find an OE part, try to put it in. But try to do your best to reduce the pressures on the vehicle.
Okay.
And be really smart about what you decide to do. Instagram can be a very dangerous place, you know?
Yeah.
Your ego is even more dangerous. You know, I want to run a big tire or this or that. It can be very cool. And no doubt, it's awesome. But if you're going to go to South America, think twice about putting that 37 on. Think about that 35 maybe.
Right.
Or 34. And get more fuel range out of it, etc. Anyway, what was the original question?
No, just the do's and the don'ts of what you're seeing kind of in the Overland community these days.
Yeah. So keeping your suspension usually within a 2-inch lift.
Okay.
For Overlands, you know, if you're doing heavy rock crawling and that's your world and you're wanting to really have high true trail performance, that's something different.
Right.
But if we're like talking long distance travel, hitting the interstate, then getting on a trail, back on the interstate, 3 states over, back to home. 2-inch lift is usually like your sweet spot. All the geometries can usually handle all of that pretty well. You can put a slightly bigger tire on. These newer trucks with their 10-speed transmissions and the hybrids, they can handle a lot more than the other ones, so you don't really have to look at re-gearing. Because the torque and the transmissions just shift through, I guess, the drag of all of that.
Right.
Much better.
Hey, so many ratios.
And then modify your vehicle based off of experience and needs that you have from going out and doing it. And that'll be, for one, the most economical and most efficient way to get the vehicle that you want.
Yeah.
You literally have to just go drive it and use it and then make the modifications from your experience.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I think that's great advice. And then I figure there's not going to be an answer to this, but I'm going to circle back around to what we talked about at the beginning.
Yeah.
Having been to 6 continents, Clay, been on all these great adventures, can you definitively say what Toyota is the best for a cross-country expedition? Is there one, or is it just so use-based it's impossible to say?
It is a little impossible to say.
Okay.
Which is so cool.
Yeah.
Because that means that there's really great selection to go do it how you want. Mm-hmm. The Land Cruiser is always going to be the most scrutinized vehicle platform from Toyota because it is held at the highest degree of reverence within the corporation. Like you're invited to work on the Land Cruiser team.
Wow.
You don't just migrate into the Land Cruiser team.
Interesting.
Would you like to come work on the Land Cruiser team? And it's like an honor to be able to work on Land Cruiser.
Wow. Okay.
You know, so there's that, right?
Right.
But the cool thing is now with this, you know, common frame, what is it, the TFNA?
TNGAF.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's so many of those componentry that had to pass the Land Cruiser specs that migrated into Tacoma, Forerunner, Tundra, and Sequoia.
Yeah.
Tundra, Sequoia from the 300 platform, and Forerunner, Tacoma from the 250 platform. Pronoflat. So we're seeing a lot of what was really important for the Land Cruiser make its way into these other platforms, which makes it tough to say which one's best.
Right.
I love the Tacoma. I love the Tacoma.
You're just a Tacoma guy,
I'm a Tacoma
huh?
guy.
Nice, man. Yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah.
So, Clay, last thing I want to talk about is some of the great success that you guys have had. Because I think that, you know, you talked about the formation of X Overland.
Yeah.
And now it's not just the Video Adventures. There's all these other brands underneath your umbrella.
Yeah.
Like Overland Journal, right?
Yeah, the Overland Collective now.
Yeah. So kind of walk me through how that happened and what you think is happening in the Overland space. And is it growing? Is it shrinking? And how that works?
Yeah. So the Overland space is very stable.
Okay.
The industry itself went through a big boom, like most did through COVID. People needed to get outside. People went and bought vehicles, and we all went camping, right? So overlandy things went through the roof. That is settled off, like almost all the industry. What do they call it? The COVID hangover.
Okay.
A lot of industries have the COVID hangover. But vehicle-based exploration in the United States and globally is doing great. It's still there's more people doing it than even before COVID now. So, like, if you look at the total curve of it all, it's great. We're fine. The reason Overland Collective came to be was Scott and I and Rochelle and the teams at Expedition Portal, Overland Journal, who we've all worked together now for 15-some years. And we've been on global expeditions together, and we always talking about this industry that we love. We saw that there were so many consolidations happening from other VC money inside the Overland space. So happens to everybody. Happened to the mountain bike industry. Happened to fly fishing. Happened in the hunting world, happens in the shooting world, all this stuff. A niche environment or industry pops up, gets a big following, eventually hits mass market, and then people see it as the new gold rush, essentially. VC money comes in, scoops everything up, consolidates stuff, and that's when a lot of heart and soul of an industry dies because it got sold to somebody else who doesn't understand.
Interesting. Yeah.
You know, so we were like, okay, we love this. This is our life. We're spending our life building this industry because we love it. We think it makes better people to go out and adventure. And eventually we're going to get to the point where we're going to have to hand this off or sell it our own companies to a degree because of the cycle of life. You know, we age out. So we're like, let's not do that. Let's figure out how to keep these core brands together and keep the heart and soul as long as possible by working together.
Nice.
So we, X Overland, we're the youngest guys in the bunch when it comes to these things. So Scott and I worked out a deal that like let X Overland acquire Overland Journal and Expedition Portal, and we'll build it under this new Overland Collective approach. So we all work together to keep the industry as cool and as happy as possible. And it doesn't get lost out to VC money somewhere else.
So wow, that's awesome. Dude, that's so cool.
That's the heart and soul behind all of it. And we took huge risks. Both of us did. We're taking big risk. So to all of you out there, thanks for watching the YouTube channels. Thanks for being subscribers to the magazine and being on Expedition Portal because, you know, we need you.
Well, Clay, man, I really appreciate it. This was huge. Congratulations on all the success.
Thank you. Yeah, we got a long ways to go.
You've come a long way.
Yeah, it's never over. Appreciate the time.
Yeah, dude, this is awesome.
Well, there you have it, everybody. I hope you found this podcast somewhat interesting. It was a fun one to make, and a big thank you to Toyota and X Overland, of course, for making this one possible. And if you want to find more podcasts, check out our podcast over at Apple and Spotify. We got our car chat, we've got talking trucks, and we also have Carist, which is our fun sort of car person podcast. It's a real blast if you haven't seen that before. And as always, head over to alttfl.com if you want to find out more on the rigs behind me, because I got a lot of videos coming soon on these machines. Thanks so much for watching. I'll see you next time.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.